Hi, this is Tiffany. I just wanted to drop in to our podcast today and acknowledge COVID-19. The Digital to Learn podcast has pre-recorded episodes, and we do plan to continue on with those during this time. But we also just want to stop and acknowledge everything that you're going through and let you know that we're all in this together. And we hope that now more than ever, you find our content about digital learning relevant and useful in your daily lives. Everybody stay safe, and we just want to wish you some happy listening.
Socrates wrote nothing. He thought that writing would be a kind of a false knowledge, and that memory would be lost, or the arts of memory, not his words, but the arts of memory would be lost if everything would be written down. And so Socrates had those sorts of concerns. Now, of course, today the idea that writing is at all problematic strikes our ears pretty odd. The same was true with printing. There were those that were concerned about the rise of the paperback novel. So one could argue that we have long had concerns about new cognitive technologies, especially because they would seem to replace cognitive technologies with which we're more familiar.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
I'd like to welcome you to Digital to Learn. We're glad to be here on the podcast once again, here with my co-host, Tiffany Snyder.
Hi, everyone.
Welcome, Tiffany.
Thank you.
And our guest today is David Staley from The Ohio State University. David Staley is director of the Humanities Institute and director of the Center for the Humanities in Practice at The Ohio State University. He is also an associate professor in the Department of History, where he teaches courses in digital history and historical methods. In the Department of Design, he also teaches courses on design history and design future. We have provided links on our Digital to Learn website to David's many texts, including Alternative Universities, Speculative Design for Innovation in Higher Education. Here are some of the ways David describes himself on Twitter: ruthless curiosity, flaneur, provocateur, essayist, educator, historian, impresario, futurist, raconteur. Wow, that's a lot of stuff. We're glad to have David with us here on the Digital to Learn podcast. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much.
So glad to have you here. We've already shared with the audience your various Twitter descriptions. So you have a kind of a wide range of descriptions of yourself.
I sometimes say I can't decide what I want to be when I grow up. So I'm trying to do it all.
That's a great way to be. We'd like to begin with some fun questions. This one will be in the this or that format. So going to give you choices, morning or evening?
Mm-hmm. Evening, I think.
Okay. Are you an evening person?
I'm not
really
a morning person.
Okay.
I'm definitely not a morning person. How's that?
Okay, that's good.
Theater, movie, or streaming?
Theater, movie.
Oh, good.
That's a different experience, isn't it?
Much more intense, fuller experience.
Sure. Yes.
You're absolutely right. Scrambled eggs or over easy?
Scrambled eggs with ketchup.
Oh, okay.
Try it. It's very good.
A trip or staycation?
Oh, a trip.
A trip. Okay.
Oh, hands down.
Do you have any favorite travel sites?
Oh, gosh. So, well, we went to Hawaii this summer, and I think I rather like Hawaii. Yes.
You're the first person to ever say that.
Yeah, right. Santa Barbara. I just love that. I just love that part of the country. It may be the most beautiful, maybe the most beautiful place in the country.
Interesting. Okay, this is a hard one. This will require some thought. Paper clips or staples?
Paper clips or staples?
Yeah.
Actually, not that much thought. Paper clips.
Oh, my. Very definite. Air conditioner or a ceiling fan?
Oh, air conditioner.
Good choice.
Oh, these are too easy.
I know.
They really are. They seem like good questions.
When we get to the serious questions, you should be scared. We're just making it light to compensate.
Well, let me begin that journey. One of the things that I found most interesting about you and your description and the writing that you do is it just seems like a very diverse range of things that you're interested in. I guess you would describe yourself first as a historian.
So I'm in a history department and think of myself as an historian, but many other things as well.
What was the journey for you to get to where you are now in terms of your learning and your interests?
I had a number of interests, I think, as an undergraduate. In fact, I began my undergraduate career as an economics major.
Hmm.
Yeah, and still retain an interest in economics. I still sort of dabble, I think, in economics, especially behavioral economics. But, you know, I took my first history class very reluctantly my sophomore year. And I say reluctantly because it was required, right? And I had such bad experiences with history growing up. I hate to throw anybody under the bus, but I had very, very poor history instruction.
Mm-hmm.
But I had great, like, you know, science and political science. If you would have told me in 11th grade I was going to get a PhD in history, I would have said, that's insane. But if you would have said a PhD in sociology or a PhD in chemistry, that seemed very, very plausible to me because I really enjoyed those subjects. So I was very reluctant to take history. And first day of, I literally went to the course catalog and, you know, sort of drew something at random. And it was ancient Mediterranean civilizations, like,
wow,
you know, Greeks and Romans. First day of class.
That could be interesting. That could be interesting stuff.
First day of class, the professor said, the ancient Greeks who gave us the word history, the word history doesn't mean past, it means inquiry. And all history is the answer to the question why.
Huh.
And I was absolutely hooked at that stage. By the end of that semester, I had changed my major to history. And the reason is that I thought that what the human beings that historians were studying were more realistic than the human beings that economists were studying.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And so I made an aesthetic choice to be a history major. But, you know, when I got into graduate school, I retained an interest in a wide variety of areas and was very lucky to have a dissertation advisor who was even more of a polymath and encouraged me to read widely in different fields. I wrote a dissertation that, while it was certainly a history dissertation, but allowed me the opportunity to explore sort of different disciplines. And I've always sort of retained that, even though it's very difficult to live like that when you're at a research one institution like Ohio State.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you really are expected to specialize. And in some ways I try to push against that. One of the ways I do that is that I'm tenured here in the history department, but I have appointments in the Department of Design. I teach occasionally in design, and I have an appointment in educational studies.
Interesting. You know, it occurs to me as you describe that experience, history is answering the question why. Is that how was it described to you?
Yes.
That it's not very often taught that way.
It is at university, I think.
Okay.
At least in my classes.
Okay.
But you know, I think when you get into elementary grade school, you know, grade schools, high schools, I don't think that's the way it's taught. I think that's it exactly. When I teach students history at university, it really is sort of pushing back against a very different way of teaching history.
Okay.
Let's just put it that way.
So I guess I've just revealed for our listening audience when I stopped taking history classes.
Oh, my.
Well, yes. In some ways, and some of this has to do with the kind of tests that students have to take, I think for a lot of students, they still sort of assume that history is about recalling mm-hmm. facts.
Yes.
And I really try to dispel that in the classes that I teach. And not dispel it, you know, to be contrarian, is to say, well, that's not what history is. That's not what historians do.
Mm-hmm.
You might as well do what historians do.
So how did you then gain an interest in digital history and design?
Oh, wow. That's a super question. So it was the middle of the '90s, probably about 95, 96. I was teaching at a small college here in Ohio, Marietta College.
Yes.
I can put in a plug for Marietta College.
Right on the river.
And exactly, yes. And the river oftentimes would come to the college. We would be flooded every so often. I was teaching a course on sort of technology studies, science and technology studies. And I had a student send me, it wasn't really links in those days. This would have been 95, 96. But he said, there's this really interesting conference on sort of the digital and the humanities of the digital and in history. And I thought, oh, that looks kind of interesting. It's not exactly what I'm doing here in science and technology studies. But, you know, sure, I'll take a look at it. Was brought into a community, one of the nascent communities there in the early 90s or in the mid 90s that was working on digital history. And just became very much involved with that group. And I made a semi-conscious decision to move away from European history. I was trained in European, German history in particular, and started working and publishing more and more in digital history. Again, at a time when it really was sort of a new frontier. The interest in design was sort of closely allied to that. My particular interest in the digital had to do with what we would today call data visualization. That term didn't really exist. Visualization existed. Today we might use the term data visualization. And I talked about my training as a graduate student, that I had this terrific graduate advisor. To give you a sense of the kind of training he gave me, when it was time for my PhD general exams, the very first book that he handed to me wasn't a history book. It was Edward Tufte's The Visual Display of Quantitative Information.
Huh.
Wow.
He says, that's the first book I want you to read. And I became very interested in what Tufte was saying and what scientists and mathematicians were doing with visualization. And in fact, when I was introduced to sort of fourth generation computers there in the late 80s, early 90s, most historians were using it really as a word processor. And I was looking at what scientists and mathematicians and artists were doing to create data visualizations. And I thought, boy, you know, what would this be like in the hands of historians? And so that was the particular sort of approach I was taking to digital history. What would it mean to visualize the past using digital tools? And that became then the subject of the first book that I wrote called Computers, Visualization, and History.
Fascinating. One of our favorite parts of doing this podcast is hearing the stories of our guests. They have all been so fascinating with so many twists and turns.
Lots of twists and turns in my case.
That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm. I want to spend some time talking about two of your books. The one that attracted me initially was Speculative Design for Innovation in Higher Education. In my experience, innovation and higher education are oxymorons. I actually purchased your book and read it, and I was fascinated by it. So could you give our audience a picture of what you've written there?
Yes, absolutely. So the speculative design for innovation has to do with the idea of imagining new forms.
Mm-hmm.
And the emphasis there is on imagination. So the title begins with alternative universities. And so what the book is are 10 models or 10 thought experiments or 10 what-ifs or 10 blueprints for different ways we could organize the university. And so we can dive into some examples, but I'll give some examples. So one I call like Nomad University. It's based on the idea of gap years. There's all kinds of interesting research, some of it more anecdotal, but it seems as though students who take a gap year before they come to university have all kinds of benefits. Aside from sort of global travel, they come to university better prepared, more mature.
Interesting.
Ready for the rigors of university life. Well, the idea of Nomad University is, well, what if you link together, say, 6 or 8 gap year-like experiences and make that the university experience?
Hmm.
In other words, you sort of travel the globe and you engage in different sort of projects. You're not at a university someplace. You are all over the globe engaging in all kinds of research and other sorts of activities. And so that's an example of one of the thought experiments. I have others. I have one that's called the Institute for Advanced Play, one that places play, serious play, above knowledge. I have one called Polymath University. It's one where, as a condition to graduate, a student has to triple major in three different subjects. And by different, I mean not like history and philosophy and English, mm-hmm. Or finance and accounting and business administration, but business administration, history, and theater, let's say. Just take that sort of example.
What kind of responses have you gotten to those various ideas?
Unlike what I was expecting, let's just phrase it like that. So the subtitle of the book is Speculative Design.
Right,
The idea here was that I wanted to use the imagination. One of the impetuses for the book was the work of the philosopher of higher education, Ronald Barnett, who's made the argument that our ideas about what universities can become are imaginatively impoverished.
Mm.
And he calls upon us to use our imagination, to expand our imagination, to think about what universities can become. And so that was one of the impetuses for the book. And I really did sort of imagine these as thought experiments, although I gesture, I guess, in the introduction of the book to say, you know, I think that some of these could be instituted. We could start some of these.
Absolutely.
Today.
Sure.
I've been surprised at the response to those that say, yeah, let's implement these. Not just simply let's talk about them sort of philosophically or theoretically. Let's find ways to implement these inside current universities.
Excellent.
Which was not necessarily what I was expecting, but have been delighted nevertheless.
Not a typical higher ed response in many ways.
Yes, exactly. Not a typical higher ed response. Your original observation, I think, is quite correct. Or how did you phrase it? That innovation and higher ed are
oxymorons. Yes.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. Or another way of sort of saying it is that what we think of as innovation oftentimes is more like incremental innovation.
That's true.
And the kind of innovation I'm imagining this book is sort of existential innovation or enterprise level innovation. I mean, really thinking differently about what a university is for, not just simply divining new ways to deliver what we're already doing.
Absolutely. So is it likely there'll be a volume two?
Oh, goodness. I'm working on too many other projects to be thinking about a volume two yet. But maybe at some stage.
Let's talk about one of your other books, Brain, Mind, and Internet, A Deep History and Future. What's the thesis of that book?
So that the internet is maybe doing something to our brains, but that we shouldn't be worried about it.
Oh, okay.
So, let me tell you where the idea came from. So this would have been around 2008, 2009, I guess it was. Nicholas Carr wrote an essay in The Atlantic that was called How Google is Making Us Stupid,
mm-hmm.
or something, mm-hmm. something to that effect. And he, in fact, he turned that into a book. I think that was the book called The Shallows that he wrote.
Yes, it was.
But his essential thesis is that increasing use of the internet is dulling us. It is making it more and more difficult for us to engage with long-form texts, to say read books or long-form journalism. But even maybe more dastardly, I suppose, he argues from research, and this research is absolutely borne out, that increasing use of screens and the internet is actually rewiring our brain.
Hmm.
And he presents this in a way that is somewhat alarmist. And so the book was really sort of a response to that, to sort of say, well, I think that a lot of what Carr is suggesting is quite true. But the ramifications and implications, I think, are somewhat ahistorical. Cognitive technologies, and I start this book by looking at cave paintings and writing systems. Our cognitive technologies have always rewired our brains. It's not that technology, the digital technology, the internet, is some sort of new intrusion upon our brains. Any cognitive technology we use rewires our brains. And I cite some research, for instance, around we've been able to witness kids learning how to read. We can put them into fMRI machines, functional MRI machines, which are MRI machines that allow you to watch what's happening as we're engaged in some sort of activity. Mm-hmm. And as you watch kids learning how to read, you can actually watch their brains being altered. And in fact, that's led to a theory when humans as a species developed writing, we had to repurpose our brains in order to engage in writing. Our visual patterns in our brains attached to our language systems. And this altered our brains. And so if you take this long view, the idea that increasing use of the internet is rewiring or changing the structure of our brains actually has a very, very long history.
Interesting.
And so I try to place it within that wider context. The other argument that that use of the internet means that we're not able to engage in the kind of attention that it takes to read a book or, say, long-form journalism is true, I think, up to a point. But again, I say it means looking only at the book as the only way of thinking about how our brain should function.
True. Mm-hmm.
And if you think about what happens, to get back to my interest in visualization, what happens when we look at visual images is a very different approach to acquiring knowledge than what happens when we're reading a book. Mm. And so, again, I try to put into a wider, very wide historical context the meaning of the internet. And then, as the book's subtitle suggests, I try to project forward about what the future of the brain, the future of the mind is in an internet saturated world.
Well, as you were describing that, I was thinking about my grandchildren, who are probably on screens more than I would like, and thinking about them 20 years out. But then I began to realize what we know today as the internet will be completely different in 20 years. So they'll go through the same process.
That's right. Yes. And I understand and maybe even somewhat share the kind of concerns that people have about screen time and these sorts of things. But one of the things I point out in the book is that, well, they were like Socrates had concerns about the written word. Socrates wrote nothing. He thought that writing would be a kind of a false knowledge and that memory would be lost, or the arts of memory, not his words, but the arts of memory would be lost if everything would be written down. And so Socrates had those sorts of concerns. Now, of course, today the idea that writing is at all problematic strikes our ears pretty odd. The same was true with printing. There were those that were concerned about the rise of the paperback novel. So one could argue that we have long had concerns about new cognitive technologies, especially because they would seem to replace cognitive technologies with which we're more familiar.
And isn't it a wonderful thing that humanity is always in a state of transition?
It is one of the few constants in life. The change is a constant.
If you thought that was amazing and life-changing, then you'll want to tune in for episode number 2. Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are 3 things we ask you to do. 1, come back and join us again. 2, tell your friends about us. And 3, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.